You're listening to Resolution Radio. Radio. ResolutionRDO.com.
Welcome to American Dissident Voices. I'm Kevin Alfred Strom. There is no deeper question than this. What shall we do with our lives? The Jews and their money-driven allies have answers to that question for us, of course. They tell us to learn to please the rich or please the crowd, and so get paid, and so have plenty of quote-unquote security in the form of a pointless or even harmful job. A house 20 times bigger than anyone needs, thrilling vacations, a dazzling variety of synthetic booze and foods, lots of orgasms and new ways to get them, and plenty of entertainment. Songs, TV shows, films, garbage mass-market books that the Jews will be happy to provide to give us a quick emotional fix, to cover up the bleakness of our lives, and, of course, to give us plenty of overt and subliminal messages to help keep us weak and blind servants of their system. But some of us, perhaps even almost all of us who have found this radio program, know that these answers which they give us are empty and false and designed to enslave us. Deep in our race soul, we know there is something more, something far greater than anything imagined by the hamster wheel runners and the gold-bedecked Jew. We know it when we behold the vastness of the cosmos in the night sky. We know it when we examine the intricacies of the smallest flower. We know it when we look in the eyes of our children. So, why are we here on this moat of lava and water and stone and cloud, suspended in the trailing arm of the Milky Way, amidst trillions of other planets and stars and galaxies? What should we do with the very limited time we have? Awakening when we are born from one infinitely long sleep, and when we die, returning to another, with only some thousands of days separating the two. One of the greatest thinkers of the 20th century answers those questions for us today on our program as a kind of culmination of his works on cosmotheism, a philosophy and true religion for men and women of European descent. Dr. William Pierce wrote Purpose in Life as an editorial for National Vanguard, then a print magazine, in June 1982. It was never recorded as a speech, so I will deliver it here in radio form, striving, as always, to be true to Dr. Pierce's meaning. These are the words of William Pierce, never before heard in audio form, in his deeply significant Purpose in Life. What the lack of any national purpose is doing to America as a nation is painfully evident to everyone willing to see. It may be less evident, however, what the lack of a meaningful purpose in life is doing to millions of the best men and women of our race as individuals. That is because most of these believe, mistakenly, that they do have purpose in their lives. What they really have is a plan or program for attaining certain personal goals they have convinced themselves are worthwhile. For example, a young man may have decided in his late teens that his goal in life is to have a career in a profession which will provide him with both stimulating activity and security, with social prestige, perhaps with a certain degree of independence or opportunity for travel, and with enough income to own all those things which are generally believed to be desirable. An expensive late model automobile or two, stylish clothes, a nice home in the suburbs or a fashionable condominium in the city, and eventually an attractive wife to give him pleasure and companionship and to evoke the admiration and envy of his peers. In order to achieve these goals, he maps out a program. First, get into the right college. Then earn good enough grades for admission to law school or medical school or graduate school, as the case may be. Then open a practice or find employment in congenial surroundings where he can meet the sort of people who can help him with career advancement, and so on. There are many individual variations on this theme, of course. For some, the principal goal may be to secure employment, which allows the maximum amount of free time to pursue some cherished hobby, whether it be skiing or beekeeping. For a woman, it may be the wholly admirable goal of bearing and raising 4 or 5 beautiful and healthy children. And her program might involve such things as diet and exercise regimens, or vacations in areas of high bachelor density, in order to improve her chances of finding a desirable father for her anticipated children. There is certainly nothing inherently wrong with most of these goals. They are the sorts of goals that normal, healthy men and women of our race have always had. And the people who have them today certainly seem to be in better moral and spiritual condition on the average than those with no goals at all, who live only for the day. We must also rate them above persons with the vapid, ill-defined goals one expects of a teenaged beauty contestant or television game show contender to admit to, such as helping others or finding true happiness. So why are so many of these best of our people, those with normal goals and sensible plans for achieving them, in a state of spiritual distress today? Why has their suicide rate skyrocketed in the last 3 decades? Why are alcohol and illegal drug abuse taking such a toll of them? Why are the brown-skinned swamis and slant-eyed messiahs, who are peddling freaky Asiatic cults among them, doing such a land office business? There are 2 answers to these questions. One fairly obvious, and one a bit less so. First, most people's goals do not exist in a vacuum, but are dependent on the social and economic milieu in which the programs for achieving them are to be carried out. A man whose aim in life is to spend as much time skiing as possible, or who lives only to complete his collection of Civil War regimental insignia, may not be greatly concerned that the world is falling apart around him. But the perceptive man, with a long-term career program, and the intelligent woman with serious family plans, certainly are. And the more perceptive, intelligent, and sensitive they are, the greater must be their concern. A personal goal, which requires a large investment of effort and self-denial over a period of several years, may be perfectly tenable in a stable society. But it becomes much less so in a society with a future as uncertain as ours has today. When people lose confidence in their ability to predict what the future holds for them, anxiety, inner turmoil, and even desperation rise right along with interest rates. These feelings may be repressed, even kept entirely below the level of conscious consideration. But they have their effect, nevertheless. It is not just that carefully made plans must often be changed to meet changing circumstances, or that planning has become more complicated, with every career plan requiring two different contingency plans to go with it. For many people, the entire framework within which they have built their plans has begun to crumble, as they are forced to question the feasibility or even the value of the only goals which are meaningful to them. Learning a craft or art which requires years of practice before it can be mastered certainly seems to be less justifiable in an era when society's appreciation of excellence and even the ability to recognize it is in decline. And when both technique and public taste are changing so rapidly that one may very well end up as a master of an anachronism, unneeded and unesteemed. Even more corrosive of enthusiasm and ambition is the individual's loss of appreciation and esteem for the society in which he is living. Most people with goals in life have more than a purely egoistic motivation for achieving them. A writer, an artist, or a craftsman may want to become part of a cultural tradition which he reveres. A man in public life may aspire to being remembered as a contributor to the greatness of the nation. Even the most mediocre careerist generally has some respect and affection for his chosen profession, for its immemorial usages and customs, for his more accomplished colleagues, but much less so today than a generation ago, and undoubtedly even less so in the foreseeable future. As for the most important profession of all, motherhood, any intelligent young woman must have at least some misgivings today about devoting her whole heart and mind and body to the task of bearing sons and daughters to carry on a family tradition when they reach adulthood and bring pride and honor to their parents. Not only have such non-democratic concepts as family tradition and family pride fallen into general disfavor, while motherhood itself has lost much of the honor formerly associated with it, but more and more prospective mothers are having qualms about bringing children into a world which seems to have such a bleak future. Misgivings about what the future holds seem to depend little on reason or ideology, with liberals and conservatives alike sharing them, but more on a generalized pessimism, which in many amounts to a gloomy foreboding, based on an instinctive or intuitive feeling that the world is badly out of kilter. In any event, every recent poll taken shows that the misgivings are very widely spread among the American public and are growing. And is it not entirely proper that the pessimism should be rampant and that people should be filled with foreboding and should question their goals in such times as these? Would it not be a sign of a far worse sickness among our fellow citizens if the best of them were wholly oblivious to the ominous trends all around them and were able to pursue conventional goals with false certainty and baseless optimism? The race still retains a modicum of healthy instinct, and that is good. But it will be much better if some of those who are now questioning their goals will take the next step, which is to become conscious of the fact that beyond the life of the individual and his personal ambition and goals, there is an all-encompassing life. And that life has a purpose, which is its own self-evolution. Those were the words of the founder of the National Alliance and the founder of the new religion for men and women of European descent, cosmotheism, Dr. William L. Pierce, in the first part of his life-changing work, Purpose in Life. We will continue next time with the concluding part of Purpose in Life, right here on American Dissident Voices.
You're listening to Resolution Radio, Radio, Radio. ResolutionRDO.com.
My brothers, my sisters, I bring you a message of solidarity, a call to action, and a demand for adherence to duty of an Aryan resurgence and ultimately total Aryan victory. We have broken the chains of Jewish thought. We know not the meaning of the word mine, it is ours. Our race, the totality of our people. 10 hearts, one beat. 100 hearts, one beat. 10,000 hearts, one beat. We are born to fight and to die and to continue the flow of our people. Onward we will go, onward to the stars, high above the mud of yellow, black, and brown. So kinsmen, duty calls. The future is now. If months from now you have not yet fully committed yourself to the Alliance, then you have in effect not only betrayed your race, you have betrayed yourself. So stand up like men and drive the enemy into the sea. Stand up like men and swear a sacred oath upon the green graves of our sires that you will reclaim what our forefathers discovered, explored, conquered, settled, built, and died for. Stand up like men and reclaim our soil. Kinsmen, arise. Look towards the stars and proclaim our destiny. Defeat never, victory forever.
We are the American Freedom Party. This is the most urgent time in the history of Western civilization. In the year 1900, white people of European descent comprised 35% of the world population. Today it is less than 9% and falling fast. Europe is being overrun with Middle Eastern immigrants, and America's founding stock is rapidly being replaced with third world peoples from around the globe. For the last 50 years, every influential institution in this nation, our schools and universities, our media, our churches and our employers have promoted policies and principles that teach whites to be ashamed of their great heritage and birthright. We, who in the 1950s, the 1960s, and 1970s were the world's dominant force, are now so afraid of being called racist that we were quailing towards irrelevance and extinction. Join the American Freedom Party today. Reach us at theamericanfreedomparty.us or call us at 701-317-5317. Paid for by the American Freedom Party.
I believe in race. I'm not ashamed to admit it at all. And that doesn't mean one bit that I'm out to persecute or hurt any man because of his race. He can't help what race he is. We believe that each race has particular geniuses and particular faults. The white race has built white Western civilization, and we think the white race should dominate in that area. National socialism fundamentally is the application of science not only to inanimate objects and animals, but to mankind himself. We believe that the communists, the Marxists, have one fatal error in their doctrine, a place where absolutely there's a hole and there's no explanation for it. They admit evolution. They admit that animals vary by breed and that you can breed better and worse animals. Now, how do they explain how there is a sudden dividing line when you come to one particular animal called man? They have no explanation. Time and again, when I've asked them, they have no explanation. They just say, if it's got two legs and it stands on its hind feet, then it suddenly becomes a special being and there is absolute equality. They're all the same. Man is an animal just like all the rest of the animals. He's more intelligent, but he must obey nature's laws. And that insofar as he is an animal, he must obey the laws that pertain to animals. We say that when the white race has produced such a wonderful thing as Western civilization, we should treasure the people that have produced that and can maintain it. And we should not mix them all up with other kinds of civilizations, whether or not they're good. We should certainly try to preserve it just the way the farmer preserves his better grade of stock. We are also, socially speaking, tribalists. You must live as social beings. You have to live with other people. And this is impossible unless you observe certain fundamental laws of the tribe, the ancient Indian tribe, any kind of tribe of people, even a wolf pack, has got to have certain fundamental things. One of these things is leadership. Not leadership by the most popular, but by the strongest and the best. Any tribe or Indian tribe or any group or family should be led by the best and the strongest. Otherwise, it disintegrates. It's got to have group pride and loyalty. You've got to have selection in the mating process, something that we have almost lost now. We believe that it is of fundamental importance to society that the strongest, cleverest, and the best of the men mate with the best type of women who will make good mothers. And when you destroy that machinery, you get what we have now. We believe that you have got to have an organic society. Now, by an organic society, we mean a society, not a dictatorship, but a society in which the parts of the society cooperate together in different functions and in peace and harmony, just the way your body works. Cancer is the wild, uncontrolled growth of cells at the expense of all the rest of the body, and that's what you have in Washington, D.C. right now. Cancer. We believe in private property and free enterprise. It is impossible, we believe, to have a society in which there is any real work going on unless people can get the reward of their effort. And at the same time, we believe you've got to have social justice. You cannot have people who are exploiting and squeezing little helpless people economically. And this is where I get in trouble with a conservative, because most of today's conservatives, I've discovered, are reactionaries. They're real anxious to hold on to their money. They don't care how they have to figure it out. They just want those money bags. And they come up with any kind of rationale to keep it. Every national socialist believes in idealism, believes in something that is worth more than his own one single human life. He's willing to die for something. When you're ready to die for something, then you're alive. And until you are ready to die for something, you have no real fanaticism. And just at dinner a little while ago with some of the fellows there, they said, were telling me, well, it's terrible to be a fanatic. Well, did you ever stop and think how this country got here? How all the great inventions ever got there? Any one of you out there that is not a fanatic on something or other, whatever it is you're studying, if you're going to be a doctor, be a fanatical doctor. Otherwise, you'll be nothing. You'll just be an ordinary old chug-chugging guy, and when you die, nobody will notice it. But if you're a fanatic, you'll produce something great. You'll create. Creativity is fanaticism. Every creative genius has had to be a fanatic. Many of them have been burned at the stake. So we are ideological and idealistic fanatics. Just like the communists, by the way. In between the Nazis and the communists is the great mass of non-fanatics, the TV watchers and the comic book readers. I will say this, National Socialism is the inevitable end product, logically, of evolution. If you believe in evolution, you've got to be a Nazi if you think about it long enough. You can't help it. But what happens is people short-circuit it. The minute they believe in evolution and scientific breeding until they come to that two-legged animal that stands up on its hind legs, then all the rules are up. We say that's not possible. You either believe in the scientific method and the truth, and you apply it to yourself without egotism, or else you don't believe in the scientific method and you're kidding yourself. Nazis believe in ruthless application of the truth, not only to inanimate matter and animals, but to you animals. People, all of us are the same insofar as we are animals and must survive and live as animals. And unless we breed ourselves better, we're going to get worse. That's what's happening. I do worship nature in that I'm humble. When I see the mighty, awesome power of nature, and believe me, I've seen some terrific power of nature, the typhoons off Japan during the war, earthquakes. I've been through some tremendous cataclysms on this earth. And compared to them, the atomic bomb is like a firecracker, nothing. And when you start to think of the enormity of space, our spacemen are just going around at the very bottom levels of space. They're no place yet. There are over 100 million planets where life, just like here, could exist. And in the face of that awesome probability, not possibility, probability, I say it's ridiculous to be egocentric and say we are the center of all things. Everything turns around us. We Nazis are humble. When I look at nature and realize how ignorant and small and feeble and weak and little we are, Nazism is a philosophy of nature, a way of looking at the world. And as I've pointed out, we believe in tribalism. We don't think we're above that. We think that you've got to have pride in your family, pride in your race, pride in your nation. That's not something to laugh at. Patriotism and pride in family and pride in race is something we should be proud of and cultivate, work on, not get rid of. Finally, we believe in morals. We believe in the traditions of goodness, virtue. Now, I told you something about what we are. But I'll do as good as I can in telling you what I think our enemies are. And our enemies, make no mistake about it, are the Marxists. The philosophy of Marxism, I believe, is the enemy of all humanity. It's the reverse of humanity. We say communism itself is the most vicious, anti-social doctrine the world has ever known, and here's why. They completely deny the very basis on which any human order can exist at all. Without humans, or at least without civilized humans, you certainly can't have human order. And the communists say they don't believe in race. They believe in absolute equality. The pygmies, the aborigines of Australia, everybody. Let them all come to Carlton, and they'll all write arias and books, and the cannibals will be producing the music and verses. That's all you have to do is educate them. And this simply is not true. This results in chaos, social chaos, which is what we have now. They don't believe in enterprise. They don't believe that people should work for themselves. They believe that the state should come and tell them what to do. They don't believe in private property. They don't believe that you can keep the fruits of your production. They don't have, above all, they have no spiritual ideal. We say the only thing that's worth protecting with your life is ideals and your family, your race, and your nation. And twice in my lifetime, I've been called upon to go out and risk getting killed. And I saw a lot of other young men doing this. Young fanatics that they made out of it, by the way. They made us real fanatic haters of the Germans and fanatic haters of the Japanese. Nobody protested that that was bad to be a fanatic when we were fighting those Japs, and I assure you we all were. Finally, the communists, if you remember when they first got into Russia, they are against morals. They had free love, no morals at all, everything was have a ball. And the result was they almost tore Russia to pieces, they just fell apart. Now, if you'll notice, they are almost puritanical in Russia. In order to make the thing work, they've had to go back to the very principles of tribalism which we're advocating. You can't work society with a communist pipe dream. Civilization is based on self-sacrifice, on the willingness of men to go out and die for what they believe in. When you get rid of that self-sacrifice, you get anarchy. Civilization is built because I am willing to give up something for my family. And the family is willing to give up something in order to have the town succeed. And the town is willing to give up something so the state can be in business. And the state is willing to give up something so the nation can succeed. Self-sacrifice is the first principle of civilization. Communism has got the fanaticism to destroy you, and it's doing it. And unless you can build up a counter-fanaticism for something you believe in positively, you will be destroyed. You are being destroyed.
Recently, there was a report out that among new babies that were born, this happened last year, minorities were now the majority, that whites were officially the minority.
And they're boasting about it. Khrushchev just said, America's so liberal, they'll never fight. And I think there's a lot of truth to that, but we're going to change that. It won't be quite so liberal. After we've had a chance to make America understand what it is and make it conscious of itself and its greatness and its people, and the white race understand that they're worthy of protecting themselves, that they don't have to keep humbling and downgrading themselves while other races are standing up and saying, look at us, how great we are. We keep saying we're ashamed of ourselves for being white. That's a terrible thing. The thing for each race to do is be proud of itself. And the white people and the good people of this country, when they finally realize that they can do that without hurting or being obnoxious to anybody else, they will finally become fanatics to survive, to keep this great country going.